Michael McMullen. Welcome once again to the WPBSA official podcast. Now, when we talk about the greatest tournaments we've seen over the years, the conversation tends to be dominated by the World Championship, and of course, that's inevitable. But turn that conversation to the best weeks of snooker we've ever seen away from the Crucible, and for me, the 1996 British Open is right up there. That's the tournament we're looking at this time, as well, of course, as the era it was part of. So it's great to be in the company of the man who won the title in one of the most dramatic finishes to a major final we've ever seen, Nigel Bond, and the man who commentated on it for Sky Sports, Phil Yates. Welcome along, guys. And I'd like to just begin by asking you both, starting with you, Nigel, to say very briefly the first thought that comes into your head when someone mentions the 1996 British Open.
My one and only ranking tournament victory, the biggest highlight of my snooker career.
And what about you, Phil? Briefly again, first thought you have about that week?
Well, I think it was relatively early in my career, and I think it remains still one of the top three finals I've ever done, certainly in terms of drama. It was just incredible. And I looked back at the footage the other night, and I still cannot believe that John Higgins didn't play for the extra red. It was the classic case of ultimate drama. The quality, I've seen better finals, but the way the crowd were involved, it's something that will stick with me forever. And of course, it's 28 years ago, and I still remember it vividly.
Well, of course, the British Open at that time was played always coming towards the end of the season. Very different to now, actually, when it's one of the first events having been revived. But Phil, that season that we were coming towards the end of, in many ways, had been like pretty much every other season in the 90s, in that it had been a really good one for Stephen Hendry.
That's right, yeah. And of course, when you turned up in the mid-90s for any tournament, you expected him to win. It was a bit like Steve Davis in the 1980s. But of course, John was a coming force. What you've got to remember with John is that he'd won multiple ranking titles even before that, even though when he lost to Nigel 9-8, he was only 20 years of age. So he was a coming force. Obviously, O'Sullivan was as well. But when Stephen Hendry lost, wherever it was, whoever it was to, it was always a surprise. And of course, 12 months before that, Nigel got to the World Championship final and been beaten Hendry. But when we got Bond against Higgins in the final, we knew it was going to be good because Nigel at the time was right at the top of his game. We knew he was capable of winning, although Higgins was regarded as the favourite.
Yeah, and we will come to that 96 British Open and the details of it in a moment. But let's talk more about the season that had led up to it. And Nigel, you had actually been quite well established for a long time. You made one of the fastest starts to a pro career that we've seen in the modern game. 95, as Phil said, you'd been in the world final and Stephen had just played so well. And I assume that sent you into the following season then with big hopes. So how would you remember the season that you had leading up to that week in Plymouth?
To be honest, I remember it. Obviously, like as Phil said, you know, I got to the final of the World Championship 95. So that was the end of that season. And then the first ranking event of the season was in Thailand.
Yeah.
And I lost to John Parrott in the final. And I think because of my results up until that point, I think I'd actually gone to provisionally number one in the world, above entry, believe it or not. And then from that point on there, though, having reached the final, I sort of struggled. Phil, you probably may know more than me, but I think coming into that British Open, I'd lost maybe three or four first round exits.
When that happens, of course, the rankings suffer, and then you become more pressure, and it's a vicious circle, isn't it?
Yeah. So my form probably wasn't great going into the British Open, and obviously back then there wasn't as many tournaments. So it was sort of hard to get a rhythm going. If you lost two or three first round matches, you were basically out of the game for, you know, two or three months. But you know, like I managed to win my first game. And then from then on, obviously, you know, I think I beat Paul McPhillips quite convincingly 5-0 first game. And then from then on, really sort of settled down and played well in the tournament.
The two tournaments I think we always associated with each other around that time, Phil, were the British Open and the International Open, because they were both on Sky Sports, very similar format. And the International Open in February of that season in Swindon really was a tournament like no other in the game's history. None of the top 10 in the world rankings made it past the last 32. And that was a week that we really remember from that season, Phil, because so many unfamiliar names came into the spotlight for really the first and in some cases the last time.
That's right, yeah. Of course, the whole week was a joke, really, because 9 of the top 10 went out in the round. The accumulative odds, I think, on those 9 matches was ridiculous. Then, well, my personal memory is that it was the hottest commentary box in the history of the world also, even though outside it was freezing. You had John Higgins going through, and at a very early part of the week, you thought, he's going to win this. There's no way anybody's going to stop him. The inevitability of the winner was immediately obvious by sort of the Tuesday of the Wednesday of the week, a little bit like when Stephen Maguire won the UK Championship. By the end of the first weekend, you thought he's going to win this, and of course he did.
Yeah, because as you say, so many of the top 10 went out early on. Then Stephen Hendry went out in the next round to Rod Lawler, and John Higgins actually wasn't in the top 10 yet on the official rankings, and he went on to win the title. The other thing, Phil, you'll remember from that is that incredible story of the match between Joe Johnson and Peter Ebdon.
Well, it was the latest ever finish, 4:35 a.m. And you look at that and you think, oh, they must have played so, so slowly. It wasn't their fault at all. What happened was there weren't enough tables to matches, and consequently, they went on after midnight, and Joe won 5-4 in the end. Ebdon, surprise defeat for him. And then, of course, that feeds into the British Open, because Ebdon lost to Nigel in the quarterfinals there. So maybe that was a knockback for Ebdon that, you know, feed it into the British Open itself.
Yeah, the thing about that Johnson-Ebdon match, I'm not sure if the exact details of it, but I think his son, Joe's son, had come to watch, but he had to leave because it was time for him to start heading towards going into work the next morning. That was how late it finished. But the other tournaments I remember coming up to the British Open, in fact, it was played immediately before, it was the Irish Masters, and it was won by Darren Morgan. He beat Steve Davis in an absolute slog of a final. I think the total playing time was something like 9 hours. Now, Nigel, you played at Goffs a number of times. It's a venue that was recently the setting for a seniors event, but it hasn't staged the Irish Masters now for nearly a quarter of a century. But anyone who doesn't remember Goffs couldn't grasp what a special venue it was. What are your memories of playing there in the 90s?
Incredible venue. Incredible venue. When people say to me, "Where's what are your best venues?" And I would always say, obviously, the Crucible, playing on, obviously being lucky enough to have played on the one table setup, and obviously Goffs. The old Wembley Conference Centre was good. But I think for it to be good, it had to be full. You know, because it held 2,500 people, like you say, 1,200, 1,500 people there, it was still like half empty. You know, fortunate to play Ronnie in a semi-final there where it was absolutely banging, 2,500 people in there, you know, packed to the rafters. But with Goffs, you know, one table set up, just like, you know, a circular venue. And you obviously, it's used for the horse sales twice a year, I think. Still is, as far as I know. And obviously you got announced where they brought the horses in. So you came up from under it, up through the tunnel in a way, where they used to bring the horses into the arena. So you were more like, it was more, you were more like gladiators in a way. And it was an incredible venue, and, you know, lucky enough to have played in the Irish Masters a few times.
Well, that's some of the context in terms of the season that we'd had coming into the British Open. But let's get to that week in Plymouth itself then, Nigel. And for you, it really caught fire in the last 16 against Stephen Hendry, who you'd played loads of times by then, but with one exception, he'd always won. And of course, he played so well in that World Final against you almost exactly a year prior to that. So how significant was it for you in terms of the momentum you were building that week to get that win over him by 5 frames?
Yeah,
to 4?
I mean, obviously, like you say, Stevens, you know, battered me most of the time throughout my career. So anybody getting a victory over the world champion and the person, you know, the world number one, the person who dominated the game through the 90s, any sort of victory would give you the confidence and momentum to kick on from there, you know?
Well, Phil, one of the other stories that emerged in the middle of that tournament was Mark Williams clinching a top 16 place for the very first time, which was obviously a significant moment. The biggest single reason for that was the fact that he'd won the Welsh Open a few weeks earlier. And he had done that really in quite an unorthodox fashion.
Well, he won 6 matches at Newport to win that event. He beat John Parrott comfortably in the final. But I think the statistic that always springs to my mind is the fact that his highest break in those 6 matches was a mere 76. And I remember Willie Thorne at the time, who's a part of the British Open story as well, we're going to be talking about a little later. Willie Thorne at the time on air said, well, he's done well, the lad, but if he makes a high break of 76 in every other tournament he plays, he'll never win one again. Well, he did win a few. And he continues to win them. And in fact, he is the reigning British Open champion as we speak.
Yeah, so that was another of the stories, Williams clinching his place in the elite for the following campaign, which I think we'd known for a while was only a matter of time. But, you know, I've decided, lads, I'm sick of this term class of 92 because we always seem to throw it in. So let's use a different term, the kids of 75. Let's call them that because that's the year the three of them were all born. And Phil, something happened in that tournament that had never happened before. It's happened many times since. We had a sort of triangle between those three players because it was the first time ever that we had 2 matches in the same tournament between 2 of that group that we always talk about. O'Sullivan beat Williams in the quarterfinals. He was really turning it on for the crowd towards the end and they were getting so excited about it all. Then he went out and lost to Higgins in the semifinals. But that was really a glimpse of what was coming ahead. They were all so young at that time. As you say, they're all still very good players now. There really was a feeling at that time that there was a wonderful new era beginning on the table. And these were the guys who were at the forefront of it, full of youth, full of excitement for everyone else.
Very much so. And of course, it must be borne in mind that John Higgins was the defending champion in 96. He won in 95, beating O'Sullivan in the final. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't an unusual occurrence to see those three players at the forefront of things. Back then, it was very much a case of O'Sullivan, Higgins, Williams in that order. But I think people who knew realised that there was hardly anything to choose between them in terms of their match play abilities. And that's been, you know, borne out over the years. Obviously, O'Sullivan is now in a different strata. But John Higgins then, I mean, when you think about it today, if someone is 27, 28, and they show a reasonable amount of form, they're regarded as young players. Back then, Higgins, well, before that British Open, he'd won 5 world ranking titles and was still only 20. He was a month away from his 21st birthday. Now, can you imagine someone now winning 5 ranking titles by the age of 20? They would be considered, you know, the second coming. But of course, back then, because of O'Sullivan and Williams being alongside Higgins, it was considered the norm.
So Higgins I didn't turn pro till I was 23, you know. So I suppose I turned pro quite late, you know.
Yeah, and you'd achieved quite a bit by 96.
Yeah,
as
I pretty much made an impact straight away. My first venue that I qualified for, I think that was the international. That was at Trenton Gardens, and there was no TV coverage. And probably that possibly helped me in a way, because the next event that I qualified for, which was after that, was the Rothmans Grand Prix. And obviously, I'd lost to Endre in the semis of the international at Trenton Gardens. But I think the fact that there was no TV coverage, it was just the same, if you like. Probably helped me. It was completely different, the Rothmans Grand Prix, first televised event, BBC. And it was so much more brighter, obviously cameras in front of you moving around. And that takes quite a lot of adapting to in a way. And you either adapt to it or you don't. So Totally different. You know, I was probably when I played Hendry there, having given him a good game in Trentham, I was like a fish out of water in a way. And it was all a little bit alien to me and not, I wasn't used to it.
But you kicked on from there. I think you were in the top 16 after only three seasons. But by 96, yeah, as we say, you were still looking for that first ranking title. And after that win over Hendry, Nigel, in the last 16, you beat Ebden, as we said, in the quarters. And then the semi-final against Dave Harrold. So much at stake for both of you. Now, he had won a ranking tournament, but just the one, and it had been 3 years earlier. You were looking for your first. So it was a massive opportunity for both of you. And what very often happens in a situation like that is the match just absolutely drips with tension. It's really close all the way, and it goes to a tight finish. And I don't know how much you remember about that semi-final, but that was pretty much exactly how it transpired.
Yeah. I think in the deciding frame, you know, we both probably had a couple of chances, good chances to win it. And, you know, eventually for me, luckily for me, I was the one who got over the line. I can't remember. I mean, Phil, you're the stats man. I can't remember whether I made any sort of break in the deciding frame or not.
You did, Nigel. You actually made a 70-odd break in the end.
I think we both had maybe had a couple of chances before that.
Yeah. So you're in the final now. You're up against John.
I was just going to say, never underestimate Dave Harrold, because he was such a rock-hard match player, incredible fighter. And so that win in itself, okay, you know, the win over Hendry and subsequently over Ebden got the headlines, but that win was probably one of the best because Dave was so uncompromising on the table, wasn't he?
Yeah, and like, you know, we grew up together on the amateur circuit, played a lot of times against one another, and you always knew when you played Dave, he's such a hard match player, you was always in for a battle.
So as we say, Phil, Nigel was through to the final then to play John Higgins, who had had that brilliant 94-95 season. And obviously the question was, could he follow up on it? And early on in the season, he plays Hendry for the very first time, actually, in the Grand Prix final. Hendry beat him. Then he beat him comfortably in the UK Championship as well, on his way to winning that. But Higgins overall has had another very successful season. And really, by the time of this British Open final, Phil, he had become the biggest threat to Hendry's dominance that Hendry had really at any point throughout the 90s.
That's right. And the reason for that was, well, multifold, really. One, he was youthful, 20 years of age, as we've already asserted. He was practicing so hard. He was a brilliant break builder, still is. The amazing thing about it was, at the age of 20, tactically, he wasn't far off what he is now. He was very much the old head on young shoulders. And so the whole package made him so difficult to beat. Now, when you consider the three people he'd beaten immediately before the final, Stephen Lee 5-3, John Parrott 5-3, Ronnie O'Sullivan in the semi-finals 6-4, that was the other thing. He was absolutely brimming with confidence.
Well, you'd been in three ranking finals, Nigel, already. The two of them against Hendry, the World Final, the Grand Prix Final as well, and the one you were talking about in Thailand. You'd actually led at one stage or another in all of those finals, but they'd all gone against you in the end. Now, was it a case, can you remember, going into the British Open Final that you felt the experience of those finals would stand to you? Or was it more a case that the fact that you kept losing in those finals was maybe making it harder for you to get the job done?
I wasn't thinking so much as like, you know, I've got to get this monkey off my back, if you know what I mean. I wasn't sort of thinking of that. I think obviously getting to the latter stages of events, finals, etc., semi-finals, you know, definitely stood me in good stead. But I just felt that I just felt confident in my own ability. I know obviously Higgins was the out and out favourite to win it, but I felt quietly inside that I felt confident and felt that I was playing well.
And you certainly played well at the start of the final. You got off to a flyer, but then John Higgins came back through level, and then you basically just traded frames
for most of the final session.
There was never, I don't think, all the way through, there was never, ever more than two frames in it. And as much as I played well, and I think if you speak to John would be the first to agree that I pretty much dominated the final. Mm-hmm. But obviously with John's, although he was young, he got like a whole dead on young shoulders. He like as Phil says, tactically, he was just very, very astute, so good. And basically, like we talk now, you've got to have a B game. And, you know, even John Higgins's C, D, E games, he's difficult to beat. And I could not shake him off.
Well, he hung in and he hung in and he hung in, and eventually he took you all the way to a decider, which, as you say, was a bit against the odds because you were playing the better snooker, I think would be the general reflection of it. It's a story that's been told so many times, Nigel, what happened in that deciding frame, but it's always been told by other people. So I'm going to leave it to you now. Tell us your recollections of what happened in what remains one of the most famous frames of televised snooker there's ever been.
Yeah, like you said, you know, I could not shake him off. And then obviously the deciding frame, you know, it was as though John, it looked like John was going to win it. And then obviously it got down to the last five reds. And then for some reason, maybe the fact that John Higgins was just wanted to get over the line, he sort of made sure of a black off its spot, where he could have got position a lot better, but he just made sure of a black off its spot and left a red to middle and obviously missed it, left me a long red. Obviously, I got in and got back in the frame, even though I was requiring a snooker.
And then it all ends up coming down to the last couple of balls. And I always remember the black when you got down to play it. As I recall it, there was no sort of big moment of trying to compose yourself. You kept your own natural rhythm really well and got down and played it as if it was a routine shot. Can you remember feeling a real...
I think that's what you have to do. You have to play the way that you've always played. You know, if I'm, say... You know, I do a lot of coaching now, and I always say, you've perfected that technique in a way to how you play, and don't change that. Don't take longer on the shot. It's like, say, for instance, you know, Tony Drago, he'd be no good if he had to step back, take more time. And so I just, you know, obviously came round, look at the angle, etc., and then just, like I say, go down on the shot that I would, you know, millions and millions of times in practice, exactly the same way, you know, same amount of feathers, etc. Just get down and you know, luckily for me, it went in.
And it was all or nothing, wasn't it, Nigel? Because playing the shot the way you played it, if you missed it, you were leaving it and it was John's title.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if it had adjured, then no doubt it would have probably stayed over the hole. Yeah.
What was it like commentating on it, Phil? Were you aware while you were describing the action for us all that this was going to go down as one of the most memorable finishes to a final?
Well, of course, until the end, we didn't know how it was going to transpire. What I recall about it the most, the crowd was so involved. Plymouth Pavilions wasn't the best venue in terms of its facilities out of the arena, but inside the arena, when it was packed, it was great. The crowd were really involved. A lot of support was there for Nigel. British people tend to support the underdog, and they were loving it when he was coming back into that frame. But my abiding memory is the fact that, as Nigel pointed out there, Higgins could so easily have potted the black, screwed back or followed through, and got position on, I think, at least three reds that were perfectly in the open in the middle of the table. And yet his mind basically froze at that particular moment. And he just birdied in the black, and then he had to pot a really difficult red to the middle pocket, the left-hand middle, as we're looking at the table, and he missed it by some way. And then, of course, the comeback was on. You know, John Higgins has won 31 ranking titles, and when he finishes his career, he'll think it should have been one more. Mm-hmm. I don't know why he did it. I don't know whether Nigel knows why he did it, but potting the black like that, it was ridiculous. And I'm sure he would never, ever do it again. It wasn't as though it was a difficult black that he needed to trickle in to give it a better chance of going in. It was a routine bread and butter black off the spot that he would pot 99 times out of 100, maybe even 999 times out of 1,000. And yet he chose that and it spectacularly backfired. It must have been a terribly lengthy journey back to Scotland, thinking about what he'd done.
Especially from Plymouth.
The only thing I can think there, Phil, is that because I, and as he says it as well, that I dominated the match all the way through but couldn't shake him off. In a way, did he just pot the black thinking, oh, what a relief, because I've been second best in this game. And then he's just potted the black thinking, that's it, 69 in it now, 67 on. You know, I'm safe. And then he's missed the red in the middle.
I think Nigel's hit the nail on the head, definitely, with that.
Bizarre. Yeah, that was my take on it as well. Even at the time, I seem to remember thinking that. And as we say, Phil, you were commentating on it. It was a great era to be involved with Sky Sports. They were showing so much snooker. They were host broadcaster for a number of the ranking events. And it was such a big part of the circuit at that time. Something that a lot of people might not remember or may not even have known at all is that their presenter at that time was Jeff Stelling, who, of course, went on to become one of the most famous presenters of any sport on British television. And the thing about Jeff, Phil, was that despite not having particularly come from any sort of snooker background, he grasped it all so well and was absolutely magnificent.
It's one of my proudest boasts that I've worked with Jeff Stelling, because I think he's absolutely at the top of the broadcasting tree. And that just doesn't apply to the UK. I think that applies globally. He's absolutely excellent. And to have those few tournaments where he was at the helm, absolutely tremendous. The other thing I have to say, that event, I commentated with my good pal, Jim White from Canada, and also with the late Willie Thorne. And Willie was in the box for the end of the final. And this is genuine. It wasn't embellishment. When Nigel potted the black and he got to receive the trophy, Willie was actually crying in the commentary box because he was so delighted for what Nigel had achieved. He was that kind of guy, Willie. He was very empathetic. He was very emotional. And it was a genuine response to something that he thought was superb.
And at that time, Phil, as well, I suppose me and Willie had become a little bit closer as well, because he'd separated, he'd moved to Sheffield, he was living in Sheffield. So obviously me being in Chesterfield, we used to practice together sort of on a weekly basis, you know. So he was genuinely, you know, made up for me, definitely.
Willie, of course, had been in the same position as you, Nigel, 10 years earlier in the British Open final as the underdog, because he played Steve Davis. The difference was that you actually managed to overcome the odds. And someone else who did that, as we were talking about earlier, just before your British Open win, was Darren Morgan, when he got his big breakthrough moment in the Irish Masters. And he said at the end of it, even if I don't win another title, I can at least tell my kids that I won the Irish Masters in 1996. Was that how you felt about your big moment as well? That whatever happens from now on, I'll always have this.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, whatever happens, you know, it's whatever happens. You know, the people can't take that away from you. You know, the successes that you've had, your victories, etc. People, you know, they can't take that away. You know, and the year, obviously the previous year, you know, reaching a world final. There's not many players that can say they've been in a world final. You know, and that can't be taken away from you.
Something you talked about after your win was the self-belief that you felt this triumph was now going to give you going forward in your career. And you remained a very good player for a number of years after that. So hard, even when you'd won your first ranking title, to win another one because of the guys you were trying to beat at that time. So how would you sum up your career post that British Open win?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose for another sort of 2 or 3 years, I was up there in the top 16. I suppose if you can say for probably a decade, obviously turned pro in 1989, first final in 1990, So probably for a decade, I was definitely competing as one of the top 16 players in the world. So I'm sort of proud of that. I think possibly you always look back on things and think, you know, could I have achieved more? Have I underachieved? But that's all hindsight, really. You can only do what you do in that sort of moment, really.
As I said, Phil, it was a big moment in Sky Sports, big years in snooker when they were showing so much of it. At that time, though, they only had two sports channels. They launched their third one later in the year. And as they were acquiring more rights, things were having to be shifted around to unusual days and times to fit it all in. And that included that British Open final, not least because there was a really big football match on that night between Blackburn and Newcastle. So as I'm sure you remember, Phil, the final that Nigel won, I think the session times were 11 in the morning and then 3 in the afternoon. Now, around that time, you, of course, were hugely involved in the newspaper coverage of snooker. And one of the big problems we had in that era was the late finishes, making it so hard to get big finals into the papers the next day. Our old pal Stuart Weir was the press officer at the time, and he said that because that British Open final was over by around 6 o'clock, and indeed papers could plan for it because they knew it wasn't going to be a late finish, the coverage the next day was absolutely colossal in the newspapers.
Yeah, it's been one of the great problems for snooker over the years, the fact that we tend to finish our showpiece events very late. Not so late now as we used to, of course, when the BBC decided to show the final sessions of the UK Championship, the Masters and the World Championship starting at 8 o'clock. They'd probably start hitting balls at 8:15. Then we'd have ridiculously late finishes. And consequently, in terms of the print media, which was really important back then, we were getting not as much in the papers as we should have. So that was really the blueprint, and it showed you what was possible. Of course, I knew that anyway, because when we went to China or to Thailand and we finished early in terms of British time, then I was always getting a good lot of space in the paper. Yeah, it's one of those things with snooker that really has held it back. Not so much now, because obviously the influence of the newspapers has declined. But back then, I think it was a real issue for the game.
I remember a couple of years later, actually, I got really lucky. John Higgins made the first and only maximum that we ever had in the Irish Masters at Goss in the opening frame of a match. So that was done by about 7:30. And I was working in newspapers by that time. And I think it was the only time I ever got anything in the first edition, because there was a big story long before the match was finished. But Sky were such innovators in snooker at that time, Phil. You know, people talk about the walk-on music and they make out that that was just a product of Barry Hearn taking over the game. Sky had actually introduced that many years earlier. And also, really, Sky were the first people to grasp the importance of live snooker, because when they did those big events, everything really that they showed was as it happened.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was the great thing about it, I thought. It was not going off tape. It was right there and then. We were greatly helped by the quality of the team we had, led by an absolutely tremendous director by the name of Martin Turner, who subsequently won a BAFTA for his coverage of rugby. He was sensational. The cameramen were all specialists as well, and they produced a great product. At the time, when I first started in the early 90s on Sky, myself and everyone else on the crew were told off in numerous letters for speaking too much, but we were encouraged to do that, to break the old mold where maybe the commentators didn't speak for 5 minutes before that. It was a new era. And I think now, basically, if you look back on what they did, it set the template for what happens these days on coverage of snooker on all channels.
Well, that event was a triumph for Sky, but primarily, Nigel, it was a triumph for you. And how things have turned around, because you talk about going into that event without much confidence. Now you're emerging from it as a ranking event winner. You've beaten one of the very best players in the world at that time, and as it's turned out, one of the greatest of all time. So did you then go to the Crucible for the World Championship a couple of weeks later, feeling, well, maybe I can go one better than last year and actually win this now?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, Hendry was obviously, you know, favourite again. John Higgins was probably second favourite. And then after that, I was third favourite, I think. But then you know, Hendry at the Crucible was difficult to beat, and in all the years, 93, I got to the quarters, 94 quarters, 95 final, 96 got to the semis, and all those 4 years lost to Hendry. You know, he was just so, and as much as how, you know, John Higgins was playing so well, but I think, did he lose first round, Phil, at the Crucible? First
no,
or second?
I'll be honest, can't remember, it's too long ago.
Yeah, I think he definitely had an early exit.
He lost in the quarters to Ronnie O'Sullivan in 96 when he'd been expected to go much further. So, yeah.
Just obviously got beat. I think I got beat 16-7,
I think it was.
16-7.
It was very similar, the semi-final against Hendry in 96, to the final you'd had against him the previous year, because in both cases, very close after the first session, only one frame in it. And then he played absolutely brilliantly in the second session and just disappeared off into the distance.
Yeah, and that, like you say, that's exactly what happened in the 95 final. I think I was, the sessions, the number of frames set in the session, the first session of the World back then was 7 in 95.
In the final,
I was 4-3 up after the first session. But then obviously, you know, had a bad second session. He played well. You know, if you play bad against Hendry, you know, it just punish you. And that's what happened.
And he went on from there to beat Peter Ebdon in the final, Phil. It was part, obviously, of the magnificent seven that he won in the 90s. But at that time, Phil, that was the fifth year in a row. Now, when you consider how many good players there were in that era, some of the old guys were still very capable of beating the top players. And then we had all this new generation of players, including Nigel, coming through. To win the World Championship 5 years in a row really is an achievement that it's hard to put into words.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. And, of course, he went to the final the following year. So he ended up winning 29 consecutive matches at the Crucible, which I personally think is a record that will never ever be equaled or bettered, purely and simply because these days there are so many great players to win that many matches at the most important event, at the most pressurised event. I can't imagine anybody could do it. Maybe, look, forever's a long time, but certainly not in my lifetime, no one will ever come close.
I don't believe that either. Nobody ever is going to, like, there's so many good players that nobody is going to dominate the game anymore like that.
Yeah. Well, no one's won more than two in a row since then. So there you go. That shows you how hard it is. One thing that a lot of people remember about that 96 final, and Nigel, something I'd like to get your thoughts on, was it was the end of Ted Lowe commentating on the BBC. And I have to say, Ted wasn't perhaps everyone's cup of tea, but for people of a certain age, growing up at the time when snooker was absolutely starting to boom on British television, any time now you hear Ted's voice, it just transports you back to a whole other time, doesn't it?
Yeah, iconic. And, you know, a lovely, lovely man. He just got his own way, his own style. And, a lovely guy.
And another thing, Nigel, I'd like to get your thoughts on that happened around that time was that it was announced somewhere in or around this era we're talking about in 96, that it was going to be the end of the circuit being open and all those hundreds of players. They trimmed it down then from the following year to a circuit of 96. I guess for someone like you, you must have been very glad that you got in a couple of years before
it went up and didn't have
to go through those millions of matches.
That's the one thing that obviously was good for me, the fact that I turned pro in 89. And like they say, they opened the game up in 92. Was it 91-92 season?
That was the first season of it, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, by then I'd got established, so didn't need to go through all those qualifying rounds at the Norbrek. So I was an established player by then. Like you say, I pretty much made it because I made an impact straight away. I think after my first season, I was 38. Then my second season, I was 21 in the world. Then my third season, I was number 9. So, it was good for me that I didn't have to go through all them qualifiers.
Phil, you did spend a lot of time at those qualifiers working on them, of course. So you probably know as well as anyone that really after a few years of that system and hundreds of players, it had to change by then, didn't it?
Not sustainable. I think when they threw the game open, they did so with all of the best intentions. The problem was that the numbers were inflated by people who couldn't play. And consequently, it was just a labyrinthine exercise to get through all the qualifiers. I think the authorities assumed, and that's perfectly acceptable for me, because I think they assumed that just the best amateurs would try their hand and turn pro. But that wasn't the case. People were turning up there, 50, 60, 70 players who weren't good elite players. And then, of course, you got the others who were decent but would never earn a penny piece from the game. And that was clogging up the system. So I think eventually something had to give. And I think they did the right thing to stop the game being open from when you said it happened.
It did bring a lot of good players through, though, the open system for all its faults. One of those was John Higgins. And you beat him, Nigel, in that 96 British Open final that we've been here to talk about. I always wonder with players like that who have that one clear standout moment in their career, and particularly in the age of YouTube now, is it something you watch back often?
Not particularly, no. I will just occasionally it'll come up on social media where there's the clip. So I don't really watch it back. People will say to me, I watched that back and things like that. But I don't watch it on a regular basis now.
And what about retirement, Nigel? You stayed around the circuit for a really, really long time, but bowed out a couple of years ago. Are you missing the game, or are you enjoying taking things a bit easier?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm still involved with the, you know, WPBSA Players Board. I'm just on the governance board now as well. So that's been enjoyable. I think, you know, I think. Some good's come out of the players board, the new structure, etc., with, you know, the prize money guarantees now, which have come in, which obviously is a massive help to the players with their expenses, etc. Obviously putting the, you know, the player support program in place as well, you know, to sort of educate players, if you like, and let them know of your kind of experiences as an ex-pro. But obviously, you know, I'm still involved now on a coaching basis as well, doing quite a lot of coaching. I'm involved with the WPBSA coaching schemes. Chris Lovell asked me back in 2018 to help with the delivery of that and the setting up of the new Level 3 scheme, coaching program. I wouldn't want to do anything else, to be honest. You know, snooker's been good to me. Like you say, pro for 33 years, doing something that I really, really love. And obviously, getting paid for it, you know, so that I wouldn't swap it at all. You know, I wouldn't change anything. So I feel very, very lucky.
So still very heavily involved in the game, but removed from the buzz and the excitement of competition and turning up and getting your cue out of the case and playing a match. Do you miss that?
I do miss that. And, you know, I could possibly have gone to Q school and I still feel, you know, my game would have been good enough to possibly, if I have a good week, you know, Q school is always difficult, but that I could have possibly got back on. But at that point, I was 56, I'm 58 now, and I think latterly I was doing more coaching, not practicing as much. I don't want to do that anymore, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours a day on the practice table, which you have to do to be able to, you know, to just have half a chance of winning. I do miss it, but you know, I've entered a few English amateur events, etc. You know, believe it or not, a few weeks ago I got to the semi-finals of the English amateur, and I was, you know, it would have been, believe it or not, I won the English amateur in '89, the year that I turned pro. So it would have been nice to win it again 35 years later. But sadly, it wasn't to be. I would have liked to have had a crack at Stephen Allworth in the final. But again, I won the English seniors. I defend my English over 55s title in a week or so's time. So yeah, I still enjoy getting my cue out and competing, but I don't want to put the hours of practice in. So when I get my cue out, it's more no big expectations, which can help sometimes in a way, because you're not expecting a lot because you've not put the sort of work in. So, but yeah, I do miss it. You know, I miss being around the tour and, you know, playing the events. There's no better buzz than sort of playing tournaments and winning a match, etc. So, but time's time. Time stands still for no one.
Yeah, it sounds to me like you're busier than you were at any stage during your professional career. And it was a career that had its highlight, as we've discussed, Phil, in 1996 at the British Open. And yeah, we've seen a lot of finals over the years go to deciding frames, Phil, but very, very few of them, when you look at it and you consider how many tournaments there have been, have ever actually gone the ultimate distance, gone to the last black. And even fewer have been won from a situation where someone needed a snooker in the deciding frame. So I know you said at the start of this, Phil, that it was one of the highlights of your career. But if we were to rank all the climaxes and finishes and decisive moments of all the finals over the years, it would be right up there, probably in the top 10, top 5, maybe even top 3.
Definitely in the top 10. I just want to say something about Nigel. You know, he won the Scottish Masters, which was a very big invitation event at the time. He won the gold medal at the World Games in Kaohsiung in Chinese Taipei, World Seniors Champion, Malta Grand Prix champion, so other tournaments went his way. But Nigel's biggest achievement in those 33 years as a professional was the fact he was a model professional. He was brilliant to be around, and he did wonders for the game in terms of its image, because he was spot on and off the table. I can't speak highly enough of the man.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And I think that's a great place to leave it. As I said at the beginning of this, for me, that British Open was just one of the most memorable events we've ever seen. So many special memories were created in Plymouth over those first 8 days of April 1996. And nobody looks back on it all with more fondness than you, Nigel. So thanks to you and to Phil for joining us to look back on it all. Thanks to everyone else for listening. And we'll see you again soon on the WPBSA official podcast. Bye-bye.